It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Voters in more than 20 Wisconsin cities, counties, and villages will vote on referenda asking lawmakers to address the so-called dark store loophole. Supporters of the referenda say big box stores are using this loophole to avoid paying higher taxes. But opponents argue that these stores are being unfairly targeted. We check in with a WisPolitics reporter to get the latest. Where do you stand when it comes to the so-called dark store loophole? Do you even understand what it is? What questions do you have? Is there a dark store referendum on the ballot where you live? And if so, how do you feel about that? How's your community talking about this? What are you hearing from both sides? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Brianna Riley is a reporter for WisPolitics. Welcome to the Ideas Network, Brianna.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me this morning.
So what are dark stores?
Well, that is a great question. Actually, this is the very topic that lawmakers this session tried to address in two separate bills. Essentially, what's happening here is big box businesses are making the argument that their own property value should be based off of the value of vacant, adjacent, or not even nearby properties in some cases. And those properties are then referred to as dark stores in some cases, which is where you get the name. But the important part is those dark stores have lower property values and can be taxed less.
So let me get this straight then, just to make sure I understand it. An existing store where they're doing business every day, a big box store, I won't name one, but, you know, whatever, and they think that a vacant store in a nearby community or something is worth the same as one that's actually in business and making money.
That is correct, yes. And there's a lot to dig into here, but a lot of this assessing practice stems from a 2008 case, actually, on this very topic, and I'm sure we'll get to it a little bit later to help clarify the whole process for your listeners.
Okay. How is this issue showing up on the ballot this election?
Well, as you mentioned before, there are over 20 different ballot referenda. So there's voters basically in 20 different counties, cities, and villages across the state. It will have the opportunity to vote on these questions. One thing to note, though, is that these are advisory referendums, so they don't compel lawmakers in a given area that are representative of a certain county to act one way or the other. But advocates of the legislation to address this issue say it's a way to continue to draw attention to the topic and potentially put pressure on those area legislators in the upcoming session.
So what they're doing is these referenda are requesting that the legislature take action. This isn't anything that individual municipalities or local units of government could actually take care of or do on their own then, correct?
Correct. So the wording of most of these questions is it's asking voters, would you support a measure, a bill, two bills in this case, to address the so-called dark store loophole? And then it goes into the definition and the 2008 Walgreens case that we'll get into later. But another thing I want to point out quick is there actually was a referendum question on this dark store issue that has already been approved by voters during the August primary, and that was in West Dallas. And actually 91% of voters there supported it.
Brianna Riley is a reporter for WisPolitics, joining us to talk about how some Wisconsin voters are weighing referenda on the so-called dark store loophole. Where do you stand on this? Is there a dark store referendum on the ballot where you live? How is your community talking about this? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So we've got these advisory referenda on the ballot in various places around the state. What's the history on this in terms of the legislature and how they've actually considered measures on this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So all of this really stems from a 2008 state Supreme Court decision. And that case was called Walgreens versus the City of Madison. Essentially, what that did is change how assessors, uh, assess the taxable value of a business. And this is often, a retail building. Basically, the court decision limited the value of leases in considering property tax assessments. This is an important distinction because before 2008, assessors largely based the taxable value of those retail buildings off of a formula that factored in the property's use and building costs. So it's a narrower focus now that we're looking at. And this past session in 2017, starting in 2017, spurred legislation, bipartisan legislation, two bills in all, in fact, one that would overturn that state Supreme Court decision, and the other that would have banned vacant properties from being valued the same as those occupied retail properties that we were talking about a little bit before.
And what happened to that legislation?
Well, they both died this session. So there was a very dramatic last-ditch effort in the Assembly during a late-night floor session back in February to try to reach a deal on this issue. But, they tried to squeeze the language into an amendment for a Kimberly-Clark incentive package, actually. But ultimately, it didn't come together. And at this point right now, there's a study committee on property tax assessment practices that has been meeting since, I think, the beginning of August, trying to hammer out a legislative fix that all sides can agree to in the upcoming session. But, we'll see where that gets us.
Let's take a call from John in Sturgeon Bay. John, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Hi, good morning. Just a comment that really has to do more with the ballot. I went and early voted with my in-laws, and I helped them read that question that's on the ballot. And I just, the way it's worded on the ballot, it's kind of tricky and a little bit confusing because it's asking if you want to close the loophole. But the way it reads is that if you vote yes, it almost sounds like you're voting in favor of the opposite. So just a word of kind of warning to your listeners, be prepared to that question.
John, thanks for that call. Brianna, how is the ballot measure worded?
So it's different in various, whichever municipality or county that it appears on the ballot can fix the wording, but it's quite long. I don't have the exact wording in front of me, unfortunately, but it is a little bit convoluted, and I can certainly understand where some confusion comes from.
In terms of the legislation, and we've got about a minute left in this segment, it died. What was the big sticking point here, and where was the legislative leadership on this?
Well, that's a great question. I think back in so this officially really that last ditch effort died in February, right? But as early as January, we were hearing from legislative leaders that it just wasn't going to come together. And these bills, we have to remember, received a lot of opposition from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, which is a big business lobby in the state. And, they've said that this is a way for governments to just further impose taxes on businesses. They say businesses are already covering, much of that tax burden in communities across the state. So on one side, you have the, business lobbies. On the other side, we had local government officials saying that they don't want to shift the burden onto, residents. So really, there just wasn't a compromise that could get through both facts of the legislature.
Brianna Riley of WisPolitics stays with us as we continue to discuss the dark store loophole, and we're taking your calls. Where do you stand on this? What questions do you have? Is there a dark store referendum on the ballot in your community? And how are people talking about it? 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Voters in about 20 cities, villages, and counties are being asked to weigh in on the subject of the dark stores loophole. We're talking about what that is and what these local units of government are asking the state legislature to do about it. Where do you stand when it comes to the so-called dark store loophole? Maybe you have some questions about this. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. 1234. Brianna Riley is a reporter for WISP Politics. Let's take another call here. Carlton joins us from Mineral Point today. Carlton, good morning.
Good morning, sir, and thank you for this topic. This is the first I've heard of this, and I can honestly say that, first of all, I'm not terribly surprised that the governments involved in generating this revenue would stoop to such low activities to generate income for their coffers. I think the downside of this is going to be some of these stores in neighborhoods that really need them are going to be taxed, if I understand this situation correctly, are going to be overtaxed to the point of where they're going to be closed, which is going to put a burden on these people in these, let's say, impoverished neighborhoods that may depend on these facilities to get by with their daily life. So I think what you're going to see is maybe one or two of, say, a Walmart or a Walgreens instead of the usual four or five or six or seven or however many there should be per capita. And I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed in the government for stooping to this level, if in fact I understand the question correctly.
Well, Carlton, how do you think a business property should be assessed? Based on what? How do we determine the value of a business property?
Well, let me ask you this question. How would you like your individual home income or your home property to be assessed? I think it should be done across the board fairly. I don't think businesses should be singled out and examined in this way. I mean, look, they're employing individuals from the community. They are paying insurance for these individuals in most cases. They pay an enormous amount in inventory tax every year. It's mind-boggling what's happening in this country as far as generating revenues, and I just think it's a bad idea.
All right, Carlton, thanks for your perspective, Brianna.
No, yeah, I appreciate you weighing in, and just to the question of how this should actually be assessed, I just want to throw in a quick fact here. There are actually three methods that Wisconsin assessors commonly use to, you know, determine market value of a given property. Right? There's a sales approach, a cost approach, and an income approach. And if you'll just let me summarize them quickly, I can kind of, you know, give you a little bit more perspective on this issue. Great, thank you. So the sales approach basically looks at what buyers have paid for other comparable properties. Then that cost approach that I mentioned, it's more so focused on how much it costs to build a property, and then you subtract depreciation. And then the income approach is where it examines, it looks at how much income a property actually generates then. So there are those three approaches that we kind of have already present in Wisconsin. So those are other areas to consider too when looking at this issue.
Well, I guess another way to look at it from a homeowner perspective, is a vacant house worth the same thing as one that's occupied? In terms of how we assess property?
Right, that's certainly a counter-argument. Yeah, an exact counter-argument that's been raised during this issue, too.
Okay. So Carlton kind of sums up what opponents are saying about the campaign against the dark stores loophole. We had voters weighing in. You mentioned in the August primary, West Dallas voters approved the dark store referendum question. What are you watching for as we move forward here, Brianna?
Well, there are a couple of things, actually. So basically, one thing that I think a lot of people were curious about is where Governor Walker and his Democratic challenger, Tony Evers, stand on this issue. And we've seen reporting from other media outlets already that both the governor and his challenger, Tony Evers, are supportive of dark store legislation. We're also continuing to see this ongoing ad campaign from the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, the Wisconsin Counties Association, and the Wisconsin Towns Association. They're all supportive of legislation to close this so-called dark store loophole. And, you know, this campaign was first launched in August, so it was really trying to encourage communities to put this issue on the ballot, put this before voters, and have them, weigh in and perhaps compel legislators to act one way or the other. But, you know, when we're looking at the swath of communities where this question is on the ballot, it really ranges. It's all across the state. I mean, we have one in Dane County, for example, in Brown mm-hmm. County, in the northeastern part of the state, Jefferson and Kenosha in southeastern Wisconsin, and Northwestern would be, Washburn County would be an example right. in that area of the state. So it's really going to be an issue that's coming before a lot of voters.
And we'll continue to watch this along with you. Brenna Riley is a reporter for WisPolitics. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
With just 1 week left until the election, Wisconsin Public Radio's Beyond the Ballot initiative is going strong. We're asking people about the issues that are important to them this election season. A recurring theme among some Wisconsinites is Governor Scott Walker's landmark collective bargaining law known as Act 10. Passed in 2011, the law still provokes strong feelings. WPR's Sean Johnson reports.
It's been more than 7 years since Governor Scott Walker first introduced the bill now known as Act 10 that all but eliminated the union rights of most public employees. 7 years since protesters flooded the Capitol. And unions vowed revenge.
When I say union, you say power. Union!
Power!
Union!
Power!
Union!
And it's been more than 6 years since people voted in Wisconsin's recall election, a race Walker won.
Voters really do want leaders who stand up and make the tough decisions.
And yet, over the course of 2018, when Wisconsin Public Radio spoke to voters around the state, Act 10 is still something they remember.
Well, Act 10 certainly hurt people in the public sector, and me included.
One of the questions WPR's Beyond the Ballot project asks everyone is whether there's a time when the government hurt them. That's when Fitchburg City worker Gus Vanderwegen brings up Act 10.
My pay didn't drop, but I had to pay for that extra chunk of retirement and whatever. So that if it was an effective pay drop that we haven't recovered from yet.
That's also when former Beloit city worker Gary Zimmerman brings up Act 10.
As I was a public employee for 36 years, and when Scott Walker pretty much decimated the unions, that hurt quite a bit, hurt me financially, and as far as my rights as a union member, I lost a lot of my rights as a union member, too. That hurt pretty bad.
Heidi Peterson of Chippewa Falls used to belong to a union for her job in local government. Not anymore.
There really wasn't any reason to participate anymore because they just don't have a lot of rights.
These are all stories people volunteer. Some remember their unions vividly. That's kept pressure on Democrats to remember Act 10, too. Walker's Democratic challenger, Tony Evers, says if he's elected, he'll repeal the law piece by piece.
I was against Act 10 right from the beginning. I would support repealing it, but we just can't wait. We have to put those building blocks in place.
For Walker, Act 10 remains his calling card.
The big government union bosses are back. Remember, we took their power away and gave it to the hardworking taxpayers.
Walker talks about efforts to repeal the law about as much as Democrats do. Polling from Marquette University has consistently found the public divided over Act 10, although the divide is largely partisan. It's popular with Republican voters like Waukesha resident Carrie Calton, who's a superintendent at a cemetery. Calton thinks government unions were too powerful before Act 10.
So when a union becomes more powerful than the people of the state, they will coerce politicians to pass laws in their favor, which don't really help an entire people of the state.
For others, unions are something they've only heard about but never experienced, like elementary school teacher Jeff David, who didn't teach in Wisconsin until after Act 10.
I came into education in 2011, so I saw the protests happened in Madison against it, and I read about it, so I guess I never really experienced what kind of opportunities I could have had as a professional teaching pre-Act 10.
Other issues are dominating the 2018 campaign for governor, but the debate over unions and Act 10 is still simmering. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can hear more stories as part of our election series, Beyond the Ballot, here on The Morning Show and across the Ideas Network. You can also share your story at WPR.org/ballot. And tune in Tuesday night, November 6th, starting at 7 o'clock, for live election coverage from NPR and WPR. We'll be here throughout the night with live updates of election returns and analysis of national and state races. You can also follow the results at WisconsinVote.org. That's WisconsinVote.org. Up next, we talk about the infamous radio drama involving a Martian attack. The War of the Worlds ignited hysteria and started a broader conversation about discerning fact from fiction. Join us for that discussion after the news. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
It's The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. 80 years ago tonight, an unsponsored radio program shocked the world with a fake news broadcast about a Martian invasion. Why did people think Martians were really invading? That's one of the questions we'll ask. Norman Gilliland, host of old-time radio drama on WPR, joins me to talk about The War of the Worlds.
Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the Mercury Theater and star of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
Norman Gilliland, host of old-time radio drama for Wisconsin Public Radio, also produces WPR's University of the Air and reads for Chapter Day. Norman, good morning.
Good morning, John Bunsen.
So 80 years ago tonight, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 7 o'clock here in the middle part of the country, this CBS broadcast goes on the air, and things escalate rapidly from there. I for those who don't remember or have any idea what we're talking about, tell us, what happened October 30th, 1938? What was War of the Worlds?
War of the Worlds was a drama that was put together in the course of about 6 days, an adaptation of the 1898 novella by H.G. Wells, different spelling, no relation to Orson. And it was a work that was put together by a bit of a committee, but Orson Welles had pretty much the final say before the CBS censors made some little adjustments, and it was a dramatized invasion by Martians of the Earth.
How many people do we think were listening to this program?
Well, you know, the numbers vary, but I think 3 million is probably about right, which was a small audience compared to the opposing show on the other network, the Chase and Sanborn Hour, Bergen and McCarthy.
Yeah, Edgar Bergen, he owned that time slot. So how then did people end up, let's back up a second. How was this program received by the listeners who heard it right from the beginning?
Well, that is an important part of the equation, John. And those who heard it from the beginning, including one that I talked to once upon a time, said, yeah, it was a radio play. It was, you know, exciting. It was well done, as Orson Welles' plays tended to be. And that was that.
Well, we might think, we maybe look back on this and kind of laugh at how credulous people were. Maybe it was silly for people to mistake a radio play for an actual news broadcast about a Martian attack. But let's do a little scene setting here, Norman. 1938, not exactly a tranquil period in world or American history.
Yeah, you remember what FDR said in his inaugural address in 1933, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. There was a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, justifiable fear and anxiety in the air worldwide and in this country too, with Europe on the brink of war, with the Munich Pact ceding part of Czechoslovakia to Germany, and Hitler seemingly unstoppable in his demands, and this kind of monolithic German force slowly taking over Europe, and it would soon accelerate, of course. And we were still in a depression. People had a lot of anxiety about that. There was fear of Bolshevism or communism in this country, fear of labor strikes and all kinds of things to be afraid of.
So when Orson Welles, in his opening monologue, says, you know, that the war scare was over and that things were getting better, more people were back at work, business was picking up, none of that was true. So that was really a fake news broadcast at that point. And then, so people, a lot of people were listening to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. So did some people then, why did they leave that program and switch over to the Mercury Theater?
Well, apparently there weren't a lot of them who did that, John, but there were some. And Bergen and McCarthy were very entertaining. Edgar Bergen was a ventriloquist, and Charlie McCarthy was one of his sassy alter egos. And you wouldn't think ventriloquism would work on radio. I mean, you know, read my lips.
It's like juggling on the radio.
Yeah, but he was wildly successful, and it was a variety show. And then at a certain point, a few minutes into the Bergen and McCarthy show, Nelson Eddy, the singer, famous for various things, Indian Love Call and some other songs, comes on and starts singing in this kind of pseudo-operatic style, which did drive some listeners late over to the other show, which happened to be a War of the Worlds.
And then, if they timed it right, they might have switched just in time to hear this.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars.
So we hear about explosions of gas on the planet Mars. This was an interruption to programming. Pay attention to that. What do we know about what was going through people's minds at this point?
Well, of course, there were bulletins coming in from time to time from Europe. And so, again, people were kind of on edge, and radio was their main source of immediate information. You're not going to get it from the newspaper, even from, you know, a special edition, a late edition, as quickly as you could on radio. So radio was a very powerful and dramatic force for bringing information to people, whether it was true or, in this case, false.
And there wasn't a radio journalism at that point. It was really in its infancy, and they didn't really have reporters. They had a lot of commentators. We'll hear from one of those in a little bit. One of the characters in this radio play is a commentator by the name of Carl Phillips. Spoiler alert, he dies in the first act, but then I've experienced that on stage a few times, so I know what it is.
The rumors are rife, John.
Yeah, yeah. And again, the program noted right off the bat that this was a theatrical production, yet people were still confused, some of those who listened from the beginning or weren't paying attention, and some of those who came in late. But let's talk about the production behind the War of the Worlds, starting with Orson Welles and his Mercury Theater Company, the one that he founded. Orson Welles, we claim him as a Wisconsin native. he was, what, 23 when he did this?
That's right.
He was a sensation. Tell us about Orson Welles.
Well, he was born in Kenosha, though he was never very attached to Kenosha. He was written up in the Wisconsin newspaper, the State Journal, I think it was, at the age of 10 as being a wunderkind. There was a picture of the 10-year-old Orson Welles. He went to summer camp in Madison for a time, did not adjust very well. But at a very early age, early teens, was already making a name for himself as an actor here and in Great Britain. And largely by a bit of bluffing and a lot of talent. And he was a very focused individual once you got him into a theatrical production, and was possibly the most brilliant of all radio actors.
And he had a lot of acting gigs. Of course, he was the voice of the Shadow, and he tells stories later that he used to take a lot of taxis from one show to the other, and a lot of things, you know, walk in, grab a script, and start performing.
He also, you know, he discovered that he could hire an ambulance to get him across New York even faster.
Well, that's clever. You mentioned that this was put together in a pretty brief period of time.
6 days, yeah.
6 days, well, but really, didn't Orson Welles see the Howard Koch script kind of for the first time on the Friday before the broadcast?
Yeah, that's right. It was within a day or so of the broadcast, and he's said, as Koch had thought also, and John Houseman, who had worked with Koch on the script oh, it's dull. You know, it's dull. And so Orson starts applying some techniques that he had and others had used in England in the 20s before, and tightened it up and put in these newscasts and in other places, though he spread it out to make it the suspense almost painfully exciting in terms of you hear these long musical interludes and you wonder what's going on. And then he breaks in, of course, with the latest bulletin.
Well, speaking of bulletins, I want to play another clip from the broadcast. Carl Phillips, a commentator, is supposed to sound like he's reporting live as the disaster unfolds. Let's listen to that.
Wait a minute. Something's happening. Humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks for the automobiles spreading everywhere. It's coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
So Carl Phillips meets his end, but what was his character, or who was his character modeled after?
Well, Herb Morrison, who had been covering live the descent of the Zeppelin, the dirigible, the Hindenburg in Lakehurst, New Jersey, just the previous year in 1937. And it's a very famous clip. Herb was out there to record sound effects, which was a new concept at the time. And suddenly he has this major disaster that he is recording and voicing, "Oh, the Humanity," the famous line from that. And Frank Reddick, who played Carl Phillips in War of the Worlds, listened to Herb Morrison's recording of that actuality over and over to get it just right. And so, you know, when you think about people who had heard, or in some cases seen, the newsreel of the Hindenburg, and just a year later, they're hearing something like Carl Phillips reporting and getting incinerated by Martians, not so big a leap for some people.
Well, I mean, I knew what was going on, and I still get chills when I hear him talk about the advancing flames, and then all of a sudden he's cut off, and Orson Welles leaves a big gap of silence before he has an announcer come in and basically say, "Something's wrong with our connection." Yeah,
very pregnant pause, very effective.
Yeah, our commentator just got incinerated.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, well, it's tough to find people to fill in when they keep getting incinerated. How did the sound and format of the show influence how people received it?
Well, of course, there's a whole spectrum of the way people received it. There were, you know, some of the people you can fool all of the time. So there were some of those who anxiously called newspapers and police stations to know what was going on. There was nobody, you know, running around crazy in the streets that we can tell. Nobody died. There were no suicides, perhaps not even any injuries.
People weren't jumping out of upper story windows. But there are some stories about people, what people did do, and we'll get to those when we continue our conversation. 80th anniversary of the original CBS broadcast of War of the Worlds. Norman Gilliland, host of WPR's old-time radio drama, is here to share with us what he knows about it. You can, too, at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson.
This time we take you to Washington for a special broadcast on the national emergency. The Secretary of the Interior.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people.
We're talking about the War of the Worlds broadcast, 1938, 80 years ago. Norman Gilliland is with us, host of WPR's old-time radio drama. Norman, we just heard from the show's fictional Secretary of the Interior, who sounds a lot like a real person that people all knew. Who was he supposed to sound like?
Yeah, Kenny Delmar, who was a veteran radio announcer, was emulating Franklin D. Roosevelt.
And this was intentional?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, again, for credibility. You know, they pulled back a lot of, because of CBS made them do it the last minute, a lot of the actual names, place names and people names in War of the Worlds. And so, you know, this was one way that they could make it sound more immediate, more realistic, was to have Kenny Delmar sound like FDR. Who used radio a lot, of course.
Right. And, yeah, the fireside chats, yeah. He understood the power of radio, and he applied it effectively, and apparently so did Orson Welles. Did Welles have any idea how people would react to this thing? Do we know that?
Well, we know what he said, but, you know, Welles, it was all about the story with Welles, whether it was a play or a newspaper interview. And he said, you know, the morning after, I had no idea. It may be true, but yeah, he was after a dramatic effect, and he was after immediacy, and he certainly knew how to get them.
Well, much later in life, he claimed he did the whole thing on purpose, and that he was concerned about how credulous people were, how they believed everything they heard on the radio, and he wanted to give them a dose of something that might make them think twice. But then that was something he said many years after the fact, so discount it a little.
He was known to say various things over the course of time.
Well, he did understand marketing. During the broadcast, after learning how freaked out some people were and all the calls CBS got, the network did ask Welles to do a station break to let people know that it was just a radio play. How did Welles respond to that?
Well, you mentioned at the top, John, that this was a not a sponsored show. It was a sustained show, and so there were no commercial breaks that had to be written into the script at any particular time. Typically, it would have been at the half-hour mark for a commercial, not necessarily with this script. And so there was a break due in about 10 minutes or at the 40-minute mark. And so Welles just kind of blew right through that half hour and waited till the 40-minute mark to make the announcement. So that much more suspense, you might say, for those who were tuned in.
And that's why he did it, to build more suspense.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it was all about the play for Orson Welles. You don't break into a really good play or even a so-so play, in his opinion, and, you know, just to stick in a commercial or some arbitrary break.
Well, and in this case, I mean, if he does break that, then the whole rest of the first act is kind of pointless.
Yeah, and there's a natural break there, too, where it goes from the Carl Phillips and the kind of immediacy and the news breaks to really a more conventional drama with Professor Pearson, played by Orson Welles, in dialogue and monologue.
Yeah, he kind of carries the second act, if you will, with his long monologue about wandering through New Jersey and going and meeting the stranger and all of that.
Which, of course, wouldn't work at all as a news piece, as an actuality. I mean, wait a minute, where is this guy broadcasting from?
Right, yeah. And of course, we had the ending there in the first act, and I won't ask for the clip, but we where the announcer's on top of this building in New York. And watching the Martians come closer and the smoke advancing, and then basically we hear the guy die on the air, and then we get the plaintive radio call asking if anybody's there in New York. And then, you know, which is actually kind of cool when you listen to it, then you hear the CBS announcer again, you know, letting us all know that this is a radio play. But for those who did panic, by the time they heard that, they were probably already in their cars headed for the hills, and so they probably missed it, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Those relatively few who did freak out, sure, would have missed it. They would have not been listening, because we all know the main thing, John, is to listen very carefully to your radio.
Yes, I count on that. Well, actually, I count on people not paying attention some days. But what happened? What was the aftermath of the broadcast?
It was really interesting because, yeah, there were something like 12,500 newspaper stories written about it in very short order. There were some people who said, well, there was a senator in Iowa who said the FCC should start reviewing all broadcasts before they hit the air, and he never really followed through on that. The FCC, however, had a very much of a hands-off attitude toward it. They did not press, you know, there were no charges, there were no fines. In fact, they barred anyone from suing CBS because of War of the Worlds.
But the network agreed they weren't going to do any more fake newscasts, didn't they?
Not that convincing, no.
Yeah, okay. But how did the War of the Worlds affect Welles' career? Did he suffer consequences?
Yeah, for him, really good consequences. I mean, his career took off like a rocket. I mean, he was already famous around New York, but then he became internationally famous.
He got an RKO picture deal.
For a little show called Citizen Kane.
So, I mean, actually, you could kind of draw a line between what happened with the publicity from War of the Worlds and the production of Citizen Kane. So one might say that without War of the Worlds, we might never have seen that film.
And he used some of the same kind of newsreel techniques at the beginning of Citizen Kane.
So, well, if it worked once, you know.
Yeah, although in the theater, nobody's going to obviously take it too realistically. But
well,
yeah.
Right, yeah. Same kind of thing. Did we learn anything from what Welles did here? Did we learn a lesson about how we consume media, or did he do more harm than good?
Oh, I think perhaps unintentionally it was an object lesson, not to be too gullible and not to believe right away what you hear, but to sit back and do a little more thinking about it.
What would be the modern equivalent of something like this? Is there a way that somebody could pull off something like this again, do you think?
Yeah, they could. Yeah, because Welles was using cutting-edge technology and technology failures of his time. All you have to do is translate it over to the internet or, some other form of communication that we have today. And with the same kind of news presentation style and the same kind of pseudo fact gathering, yeah, you could pull it off.
When we listen to, unfortunately, the recordings that we have are pretty scratchy, and we weren't doing the industry wasn't doing maybe as good a job of preserving some of its audio in 1938 that we do now. But even so, when we listen to it today. And when people listen to it, because you've played it on the radio a number of times, what kind of responses do we still get from this?
Oh, well, people love that show. But I like to remind people that that was just one of a number of Mercury Theater and Campbell Playhouse, pretty much the same show, just sponsored versus unsponsored, that Orson Welles produced. He did a wonderful Dracula in the beginning of the Mercury Theater. He did Treasure Island, Tale of Two Cities, and a whole bunch of shows that are, in some people's minds, even better than War of the Worlds.
And he did Julius Caesar.
Yes, he did it with a news presentation format. So there it is again.
And do recordings of some of those other examples of the Mercury Theater still exist?
Yeah, they're on there. Yeah, you can find them online.
Okay, so we could go and listen to this. Yeah, and I have listened to some of them. I just haven't gotten around.
You have to have a good scratchy filter, though. You got to be able to listen through some of those scratches and pops. But it's part of the sound, in my opinion.
It's worth it. I'm trying to imagine what it must have been like in that studio, watching him work and being part of that. It must have been just really exceptional.
Intense.
Yeah. And the orchestra is right there, and you've got
live music.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have anything like that really anymore.
We're trying, John.
Yeah, I know. And you produce a lot of radio drama, and people really enjoy it when you do it. And I'm hoping we can continue that. Norman, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning to talk about War of the Worlds. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Norman Gilliland hosts old-time radio drama for Wisconsin Public Radio. He also produces WPR's University of the Air, reads for Chapter a Day, and, of course, has been a longtime host of classical music on our NPR News and Classical Music Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. For real, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.